A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You probably think you know what public housing is, but the reality is a patchwork of wildly different programs that can make or break a family's stability depending on which state they live in. With the midterm elections approaching and housing costs crushing renters in cities across the country, state-level policy divergence is more consequential than it's ever been. So Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what public housing actually is, how states differ and how much they provide, and what it takes to qualify. Let's dig in.
This is one of those topics where the ground keeps shifting under people's feet. Most folks have a mental image, the brick towers, the projects, and that image is about 30 years out of date. The high-rises people picture, the Pruitt-Igoe model, most of those have been demolished. What's left is a much more scattered, less visible system. And the rules governing it have changed so much that even people living in public housing sometimes don't know what program they're actually under.
Which is by design, honestly. Complexity makes things harder to defend. So let's start with the basics. What actually counts as public housing? And who's in charge?
Public housing, strictly defined, is government-owned rental housing for low-income households. The key word is owned. The government, usually through a local public housing authority, or PHA, is the landlord. It owns the building, maintains it, collects the rent. That's what separates it from Section 8 vouchers, which are tenant-based subsidies. The tenant gets a voucher and takes it to a private landlord. And it's different from LIITC, the low-income housing tax credit, which gives tax breaks to private developers who build affordable units. Public housing is the government directly providing homes.
It's the difference between the government running the restaurant, the government giving you a gift card, and the government paying a restaurant to keep some items cheap.
That's actually perfect. And I'd extend that analogy. When the government runs the restaurant, it also decides where to put the kitchen, what's on the menu, and whether to renovate or just let the ceiling cave in. And the federal role here is specific but limited. HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, sets broad rules. They define eligibility thresholds. They provide the bulk of the funding. They oversee the PHAs. But the roughly 3,000 PHAs across the country control allocation, waitlist management, maintenance, and in many cases, demolition and redevelopment decisions. So you get massive variation.
3,000 separate fiefdoms.
And the scale has been shrinking. As of 2025, there are about 1.2 million public housing units in the U.S., down from 1.4 million in 2000. That's a net loss of 200,000 units over 25 years, mostly through demolition and redevelopment programs like Hope 6 and Choice Neighborhoods, which replace dense public housing with mixed-income developments and typically fewer total units.
We're losing units even as demand goes up. That's like bailing water out of a boat while the hole gets bigger.
And that loss isn't distributed evenly. Which brings us to the state-by-state picture, and the numbers are stark.
Hit me with them.
New York City's Housing Authority, NYCA, alone, has about 175,000 units, serving over 400,000 residents. The entire state of Texas has about 30,000 units for a population that's larger than New York's. California has around 135,000 units across all its PHAs. Massachusetts has about 45,000. And then you've got states like Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, each with fewer than 15,000 units total.
New York City, one city, has nearly six times the public housing of Texas. That's not just a difference in population density. That's a difference in philosophy.
It's history and political will. New York invested massively in public housing starting in the 1930s, and it kept investing for decades. Texas never did. And there's a funding layer here that's easy to miss. HUD's federal dollars cover operating costs and capital improvements, but those allocations have been chronically underfunded. HUD's own estimate puts the capital backlog at over $80 billion nationwide. Some states supplement with their own general fund dollars. New York and California put significant state money into public housing capital improvements. Massachusetts has the MRVP, the Massachusetts Rental Voucher Program, which is state-funded and supplements federal units. Connecticut has a state-funded public housing portfolio. That's four states: California, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, with meaningful state-level public housing investment. Most other states rely almost entirely on federal dollars.
Four states out of 50. So in 46 states, if federal funding falls short, the buildings just deteriorate. But what does that actually look like on the ground? How does a PHA in, say, Alabama deal with a capital backlog when there's no state money to tap?
They defer maintenance on everything that isn't an immediate life safety threat. So the roof leaks, they patch it instead of replacing it. The elevator breaks, they fix the one that's completely dead and hope the other one holds. Eventually, units become uninhabitable and they take them offline. Once a unit is offline, it's incredibly hard to bring it back, because the cost of rehabilitation is often higher than the PHA's entire annual capital budget. So the unit sits vacant, sometimes for years, in the middle of a housing crisis. I spoke with a housing director in rural Mississippi a few years ago who had 43 units offline in a 70-unit complex, more than half her stock, and her entire capital budget for the year was $80,000. That wouldn't even cover one roof replacement.
The federal government has been quietly retreating from public housing for 50 years, and most states haven't stepped in to fill the gap. And the people living in those units are just watching the ceiling crumble in slow motion.
You see it in deferred maintenance, units taken offline, eventual demolition. It's a slow motion collapse, and it's almost invisible because it's happening in places that don't make national news.
What about eligibility? The prompt asks how you actually qualify, and I'd guess it's not the same in Alabama as it is in California.
The federal baseline is that you need to earn below 50% of area median income, AMI, to qualify for public housing, and you pay 30% of your income in rent. It's not free, which is a common misconception. But states and local PHAs can layer on their own preferences and priorities. California, for example, prioritizes homeless veterans and foster youth aging out of the system. Florida allows local PHAs to favor working families, the idea being to maintain some economic mix. Massachusetts uses its state voucher program to supplement federal units, effectively expanding eligibility. Washington State uses a single centralized waitlist for most PHAs. Illinois lets each PHA run its own.
That waitlist fragmentation is where a lot of the dysfunction lives. How does that work in practice? If I'm a low-income family in Illinois versus Washington, what's my actual experience trying to get into the system?
In Washington, you go to one website. You create a profile. You enter your income, your household size, your location preferences. You're placed on a single statewide waitlist. When a unit opens up anywhere in the system, the algorithm matches the next eligible household. You can see your position, you get updates. It's not perfect, but it's functional. In Illinois, you have to identify which PHAs serve the areas you'd consider living in. There are dozens. Each one has its own application window, its own forms, its own preferences. Some have online portals. Some require paper applications. Some don't answer the phone. You might be on six different wait lists and have no idea where you stand on any of them. If you miss a letter because you moved, and low-income families move a lot, you get dropped, and you might not even know it.
The same federal program, the same federal dollars, but the experience of accessing it is completely different depending on which state line you're standing behind.
It's brutal. Chicago's Housing Authority opened its waitlist in 2023 for the first time in years. It was open for 48 hours. They received 80,000 applications. For a system that has about 21,000 public housing units. So you've got 80,000 households competing for a tiny pool of units, and the window to even apply was 2 days.
If you didn't hear about it in time, you're just locked out for years. And how would you hear about it? Is there a notification system?
The CHA did put out press releases and social media posts. But if you're working two jobs, if you don't follow the Housing Authority on Twitter, if you're not plugged into the local advocacy networks that spread the word, you miss it. And that's not an accident. PHAs close waitlists when the queue gets so long that keeping it open is administratively pointless. Some waitlists are a decade long. In high-demand cities, the practical advice is to get on every waitlist you can in multiple jurisdictions and hope one opens up.
Which means housing stability depends partly on how good you are at navigating bureaucracy. That's a skill, and not everyone has it.
And that varies by state, too. Some states have invested in centralized online portals. Washington's system lets you apply to multiple PHAs through one website. Other states, you're calling individual housing authorities, hoping someone answers, hoping the waitlist is even open. I've talked to families who keep a spreadsheet of every PHA within 100 miles, with notes on when each one last opened its waitlist, what the phone number is, who they talk to. It's a part-time job just trying to get housing.
We've got variation in how many units exist, variation in who gets priority, variation in how you even apply. What about the funding side? You mentioned the $80 billion capital backlog. Where does that money actually come from? Or not come from?
The main federal funding streams are the Public Housing Operating Fund and the Public Housing Capital Fund. The operating fund covers day-to-day costs, utilities, staff, basic maintenance. The capital fund covers major repairs, roofs, elevators, plumbing systems. Both have been flat or declining in real terms for decades. In 2024, the operating fund was about $5 billion and the capital fund was about $3.5 billion. HUD's own analysis says the operating fund covers only about 86% of what PHAs actually need to run their buildings properly.
Even at the federal level, we're structurally underfunding the existing stock, let alone building new units. And that 86% figure, what does that actually mean for a PHA budget?
It means that every year, they're running the deficit on operations. They're choosing between paying the heating bill and fixing the elevator. They're cutting staff who process applications and do maintenance checks. They're deferring preventive maintenance, which means small problems become big problems. A leaky pipe that could have been fixed for $500 becomes a ceiling collapse that costs $20,000. The underfunding compounds.
Here's where the state-level divergence becomes a wealth transfer issue.
Wealthier states with strong tax bases, California, New York, Massachusetts, can backfill with state dollars. California's proposition. One in 2024 authorized billions in state bonds for housing, including public housing capital improvements. New York's budget routinely includes hundreds of millions for NYCHA repairs. But if you're in Mississippi or Alabama, where state general fund contributions to public housing are effectively zero, you're entirely dependent on federal appropriations. When those fall short, units go offline. And once a unit is offline, bringing it back is far more expensive than maintaining it.
The same low-income family, same federal eligibility, same 30% of income. But in one state, they get a maintained unit with working heat, and in another, they get a building with mold and broken elevators.
That's not hypothetical. NYCHA has been under federal monitorship for years over conditions. Lead paint, mold, heating failures, and it's still better funded than most PHAs in the South. The Government Accountability Office found that some rural PHAs in the South have capital backlogs that exceed their entire annual budget by a factor of 10.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper.
I was thinking more like a symphony performed on instruments that haven't been tuned since the Nixon administration. But here's a fun fact that ties into this. The oldest continuously operating public housing in the U.S. is Techwood Homes in Atlanta, built in 1936. It was the first federal public housing project in the country. It's since been redeveloped, but the original buildings were designed with courtyards and green space. They were considered models of progressive urban planning. And now we're talking about public housing as if it's inherently miserable, but the early vision was genuinely aspirational.
That's actually a useful corrective. The original public housing wasn't designed as warehousing for the poor. It was designed as decent, affordable homes for working families. Somewhere along the way, we lost that vision.
And part of that loss was deliberate. In the 1950s and 60s, public housing became increasingly restricted to the very poorest households, which concentrated poverty. Maintenance budgets got cut. The buildings deteriorated. And the public narrative shifted from, this is a stepping stone, to, this is a trap. Policy choices created that reality, and then we used that reality to justify further disinvestment.
Let's talk about the waitlist mechanics more concretely. You mentioned Chicago's 48-hour window. What does the application process actually look like, step by step?
It varies enormously. In a centralized state like Washington, you create one profile, you list your preferences, geographic area, unit size, and you're placed on a unified waitlist. When a unit becomes available, the system matches the next eligible household. In a fragmented state like Illinois, you're dealing with dozens of separate PHAs, each with its own application process, its own preferences, its own waitlist opening schedule. You might be on 6 different waitlists and have no idea where you stand on any of them.
The preferences, those priority categories, they can completely change your odds.
If you're a homeless veteran in California, you're near the top of the list. If you're a working family in Florida, you might get preference over a family on public assistance. Florida has what they call a working family preference that some PHAs use. In Massachusetts, if you're enrolled in the state's MRVP program, you might be able to convert that to a federal public housing unit when one opens. These preferences are state and local policy choices, and they reflect different theories about what public housing is for. Is it housing of last resort for the most vulnerable? Is it workforce housing for the working poor? Is it a stepping stone to stability? Different states answer that differently.
The answer determines who gets a roof. But what about the people who don't fit neatly into any preference category? The family that's not homeless, not a veteran, not aging out of foster care, just poor and struggling.
And in a system with limited units and long wait lists, not fitting a priority category can mean never getting housed through public housing at all. That's where vouchers theoretically fill the gap, but as we'll get to, vouchers have their own access problems.
Here's a dimension most people miss, portability.
If you get a Section 8 voucher, you can theoretically take it anywhere in the country. It's federally funded and portable. Public housing is not portable. If you get a unit in Chicago, you live in Chicago. You move to another city, you start over. So public housing ties you to a specific place, which can be a stability asset or a trap, depending on whether that place has jobs, schools, transit.
Right. If you're in a public housing unit in a city with good transit and a strong job market, you're in a decent position. If you're in a rural PHA in a declining town, you're stuck. And that's the geographic inequality baked into the system. But the US isn't the only country grappling with this. Let's zoom out and look at how other nations handle the same challenge, because the contrasts are instructive.
This is where things get really interesting, because other countries have made fundamentally different choices about what housing policy is supposed to accomplish.
I've heard Vienna come up in housing conversations. What's their model?
Vienna is the gold standard for social housing in Europe. About 60% of the city's residents live in subsidized housing, either public housing owned by the city or nonprofit cooperative housing. It's funded by a dedicated 1% payroll tax, which generates a steady, predictable revenue stream that isn't subject to annual budget fights. The city owns about 220,000 units, and nonprofit housing associations manage another 200,000. And here's the thing, it's not just for the very poor. Vienna's income limits for eligibility are high enough that the middle class qualifies. The result is mixed income communities where social housing doesn't carry the stigma it does in the US.
It's not housing of last resort. It's just housing. But doesn't that raise the question? If the middle class qualifies, doesn't that crowd out the poorest households?
It's a fair question, and the answer is complicated. Vienna's system is large enough that it can serve both populations. About 60% of residents are in social housing. That's not a marginal program, it's the mainstream. And because middle-class residents are in the system, they have a political stake in maintaining it. They vote for funding. They complain when maintenance slips. The political constituency for housing quality is broad, not narrow. The downside is that wait times can be long, 2 to 5 years depending on the district, and the system is under pressure from population growth. But the fundamental commitment is different. Vienna sees housing as infrastructure, like roads or schools. The US sees it as a safety net program that we're ambivalent about.
You mentioned Singapore earlier. That's a completely different animal, right?
Singapore is unique. The Housing and Development Board, or HDB, provides housing for about 80% of the population, with a 90% homeownership rate. The government builds massive apartment complexes and sells units on 99-year leases. Prices are subsidized, and there are strict resale restrictions to prevent speculation. You have to live in the unit for a minimum period before you can sell, and there are ethnic integration quotas to prevent segregation. It's state-driven homeownership at a scale no other country has attempted. It has produced remarkably high homeownership rates and housing stability. But there are real criticisms. The ethnic quotas, while intended to prevent enclaves, have been criticized as a form of social engineering that can limit where minority families can live. The 99-year lease model means that as leases approach expiration, older units lose value. It's not truly permanent ownership. And the system depends on a level of state control over land use that would be politically impossible in the U.S.
Right? Singapore has compulsory land acquisition powers. The government can essentially take private land for public development at below market rates.
Which is how they assembled the land for HDB estates in the first place. That's not happening in the U.S. So the question becomes, what can the U.S. actually learn from these models, given our very different political and legal landscape?
The Vienna model points to dedicated funding streams. Instead of annual appropriations, a small payroll tax or dedicated bond measure. We've seen some movement there. You mentioned California's Prop 1.
In 2023, Oregon passed House Bill 2009, which was the first state law in the country to explicitly fund mixed-income social housing. It created a revolving loan fund for housing developers to build publicly owned, permanently affordable housing. Colorado followed in 2025 with a similar model using state bonds for social housing construction. These are small, we're talking a few thousand units each, but they signal a potential shift in how states think about their role.
Define social housing here, because it's different from traditional public housing, and I think people conflate the terms.
Social housing, as the term is being used in these state experiments, typically means publicly owned or controlled housing that serves a mix of income levels, not just the very poor. The idea is to avoid concentrating poverty, to create a broader political constituency for public investment, and to generate revenue from higher income tenants that help subsidize lower income units. It's closer to the Vienna model than to traditional U.S. public housing. In traditional U.S. public housing, you have to be below 50% of AMI. In a social housing model, you might have units rented to households at 80%, 100%, even 120% of AMI, with the higher rents cross-subsidizing the lower ones.
It's an attempt to build the kind of mixed-income public housing that Hope 6 was supposed to create, but with public ownership retained rather than handed to private developers.
Right, and that's the key distinction. Hope 6 demolished public housing and replaced it with mixed-income developments, but many of those replacement units were vouchers or LIITC properties, not publicly owned units. The total number of deeply affordable public housing units decreased. Oregon and Colorado are trying to build new publicly owned stock at mixed income levels with state money.
We're talking about a few thousand units in a country that's lost 200,000 public housing units since 2000. Is this actually a meaningful countertrend, or is it a symbolic gesture?
It's a drop in the bucket, but it's a drop that reverses a 50-year trend. Since the 1970s, federal policy has shifted decisively from building public housing to subsidizing private landlords, vouchers, and tax credits. The number of households receiving vouchers has grown from about 1.6 million in 2000 to over 2.3 million today. Vouchers are now the dominant form of federal housing assistance. Public housing is the legacy system.
That shift to vouchers creates its own problems, because vouchers depend on private landlords accepting them.
Here's the statistic that ties this whole conversation together. As of 2026, 28 states still allow landlords to discriminate based on source of income. That means a landlord can legally refuse to rent to you because you have a voucher. In those states, you can have a voucher in hand and still not find housing.
You've got a federal subsidy. You jumped through all the hoops. You've waited on the wait list. And a landlord can just say no vouchers, and that's perfectly legal in more than half the country.
In more than half the states, yes. The states that have banned source of income discrimination, California, New York, Massachusetts, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, and about 15 others, they've effectively made vouchers usable. In the other 28 states, a voucher is a hunting license in a forest where most of the trees have no voucher. Signs. And here's what that looks like in practice. A family in Dallas gets a voucher after years on the wait list. They have 60 to 90 days to find a landlord who will accept it. They call dozens of listings. Half the landlords don't call back. Of those who do, many say they don't take vouchers. The clock runs out and the voucher expires. They go back on the wait list. That happens thousands of times a year.
The voucher versus public housing debate is a false binary. The real question is whether states are willing to ensure that low-income families can actually access housing, whether through direct public provision or through effective voucher enforcement.
The answer, in most states, is no, or at least not sufficiently. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition reports that for every 100 extremely low-income renter households in the U.S., there are only 37 affordable and available rental units. That's a national shortage of about 7 million units. Public housing is one piece of a much larger affordability crisis.
If you're a low-income renter listening to this, what do you actually do with this information? Give me the practical playbook.
First, check your state's PHA waitlist status. Most PHAs have websites that tell you whether waitlists are open and what preferences apply. If you're in a state with a centralized system like Washington, you can get on multiple waitlists at once. If you're in a fragmented state, you need to check each PHA individually. Second, check whether your state has state-funded programs beyond federal public housing, things like Massachusetts's MRVP or California's state housing programs. These are separate from federal assistance and may have different eligibility rules. Third, if you're in one of the 28 states without source of income protection, know that your voucher may face landlord rejection and factor that into your search timeline. Give yourself as much time as possible and start calling landlords before you even have the voucher in hand to gauge the landscape.
Those are practical, but they also underline how much of this is just luck of geography. You happen to be born in California, you've got options. You happen to be born in Mississippi, you don't.
For advocates and voters, the leverage point is the state level. Federal policy sets the floor, but states decide whether to build on it. Pushing for state-funded housing bonds, like California's Prop 1, or source of income discrimination laws, like Utah's 2025 bill that finally banned the practice there. Those are concrete, winnable fights that directly affect whether low-income families can find and keep housing.
Utah banning source of income discrimination in 2025 is an interesting case, because Utah is not exactly a big government state. How did that happen?
It was a broad coalition. Housing advocates, faith-based organizations, even some landlord groups who saw the writing on the wall and wanted consistent rules rather than a patchwork of local ordinances. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which has significant influence in Utah, has been increasingly vocal on housing issues, framing it as a moral concern about family stability. That shifted the political calculus in a way that doesn't map neatly onto left-right divides.
That's the thing. Housing policy doesn't split cleanly along partisan lines.
It doesn't. Some of the most innovative state-level housing work in the last few years has come from places like Utah and Oregon, which have very different political cultures but share a recognition that the market alone isn't solving the problem. Montana passed a suite of pro-housing bills in 2023 that included zoning reforms and state funding for affordable housing. That's a Republican-controlled legislature in a state not known for government intervention.
What's the open question we should leave listeners with?
As housing costs continue to outpace wages, will more states follow Oregon and Colorado toward social housing? Publicly owned, mixed income, permanently affordable, or will the U.S. continue its 50-year retreat from direct provision? The 2026 midterms could shift this dramatically. There are ballot initiatives in Arizona, Nevada, and Michigan on housing funding. The direction those go will tell us a lot about whether the Oregon-Colorado model is an outlier or the start of something bigger.
If you're in one of those states, now you know what's at stake. This isn't abstract policy. It's whether your neighbor can keep a roof over their head.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, explorers in the Solomon Islands measured a single ice cave chamber on Guadalcanal at nearly 400 cubic meters, roughly the volume of a modern three-bedroom apartment. The cave was used by local inhabitants as a cold storage facility for fish, predating mechanical refrigeration by over a century.
So public housing in the Solomon Islands was literally a hole in the ground, and it still had better temperature control than some NYCHA buildings.
Hilbert, you've outdone yourself. That was almost relevant.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you found this useful, leave a review. It helps other curious listeners find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us. show my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.